TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, no matter what happens in today's discussion, there's one thing you must remember. Don't die. If you do, you'll be stuck analyzing this episode forever.
Chris, that's as good a reason as any. Not to die. Not a reflection on the episode, but I'm just thinking to myself, do I want to be doing that for the rest of my life? And yes, I know that I'm 44, so I'm mid-age here, but I still don't even want half of my life to be that. So,
well, just imagine if this were Profit and Lace we were talking about instead of Battle Lines.
Oh, how dare you. How dare you?
That's the one you definitely don't want to get stuck talking about.
That's absolutely the one I don't. No.
Forever.
Oh, gosh. No, God, please, no.
No. All right, everyone. We are going to be continuing our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today with episode 12 or 13, if you count Emissary as 1 and 2, as some people do. This is Battle Lines, and here is a quick rundown of the story. A joyride to the Gamma Quadrant turns deadly for Kai Opaka, at least until she springs back to life. Along with Sisko, Kira, and Bashir, the spiritual leader of Bajor finds herself marooned on some sort of prison colony, where it is impossible to die, and warring factions fight in an endless cycle of conflict. Die once on this moon, and, well, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. But for Kai Opaka, that's okay, because she has found a new calling, a new charge from the prophets, and it's one that changes not only her life, but Kira's as well. So, Matthew, I thought that might be a great place for us to start, just talking about the influence of Opaka. And also what the story does for Kira's character.
Welcome to the Hotel DS9, yeah.
I was thinking of it as the Hotel Tevlin D because they actually give this planet a name in the novel Rising Sun by S.D. Perry.
It's funny that you mentioned that because it truly is exactly what this is. I mean, like, this is... Hotel California.
Yeah. And you can check out, literally, you can check out of life, but you can never leave. You're right back after a few minutes. I don't know how long it takes.
Yeah, this Hotel California is definitely worse than the one in the song, for sure. So, but...
there are no mirrors on the ceiling here, for one thing.
Oh, my.
Although I will say that these caves are very well lit.
They are. They're very well lit. back to Kai Opaka, and speaking of her influence, I think the beauty of this episode is how well it does with creating this character of Mystique, but truly this character who has the spiritual gravitas to help move our main character of Kira from one place to the next. And I think every time I watch this episode, I'm struck by how I wish that they followed up on the fact that she says that she and Sisko will meet again, because there's so much.
Unless they're talking about the visions and the orb shadows and all that come later.
But I think this is a character that really helps set the tone for Deep Space Nine from the start, obviously. But even in this episode mm-hmm. of that, this series is going to be so much about the way in which people of faith are going to be portrayed as characters to which we see as good characters, characters that are helpful. Mm-hmm. You think of the way in which, and rightfully so in some places, and I think not so rightfully so in others, where, you know, priests specifically have been become demagogues in whatever they're in. Again, sometimes that's earned and rightfully so, and sometimes it's not. But I think that we see here that people of faith, especially faith leaders, given such respect and shown actually mm-hmm. the ways in which they truly can help people overcome these terrible moments in their life. I mean, you know, Kira here, what she's processing is literally a lifetime of violence and realizing mm-hmm. that she's kind of stuck in a moment that she can't get out of. We're quoting a lot of songs here. And so yeah. I think there's something so wonderfully beautiful about Opaka and her influence, the actress portraying her. Everything about her, I think, mm-hmm. works in this episode. And then, of course, just the way in which she's able to help Kira take that first step towards healing is incredibly mm-hmm. beautiful, incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're right. Camille Saviola, who plays Opaka, I think does a really fantastic job with the character, and especially in this episode has the presence to get across the message and the impact of how her character relates to Kira. We talked about her quite a bit when we did our episode that was focused exclusively on Kai Opaka, which is the orb 69, if anyone wants to go back and listen to us talk in detail about Kai Opaka there. But yeah, absolutely. I think here, one thing that's interesting to me in the story is that the original, when they were originally writing the story, they had thought about creating a new character who would die on this moon. And then they decided to use Kai Opaka because they felt like she was the most expendable of the characters that they had established, which I find interesting because for me, the core of this story and the reason why I put this first on the outline is the Kira Opaka element and what all you just talked about. And so I cannot imagine this story working out with a different character. It would have been generic mm-hmm. TNG yeah. story 101, I think, in that case, and still have a good message about the futility of war and how conflict kind of mindlessly goes on forever, but it would not have had any real impact right. on the DS9 right. story. But because of Opaka's presence here, it really does. And one thing that I feel ties into what you're talking about that I really liked was the exchange where, you know, Opaka tells Kira a bit earlier that this is not your fight, but Kira is determined to take charge, set up defenses. She's right back in that mode of protecting people. And finally, when Opaka talks to her and she holds her ear, as the Bajorans do, and Kira starts breaking down and she says, "I've known nothing but violence since I was a child." And Opaka says that in the eyes of the prophets, we are all children. Bajor has much to learn from peace. And Kira says, "I'm afraid the prophets won't forgive me." Opaka tells her, "They're just waiting for you to forgive yourself." And I feel that really is the biggest takeaway from this episode.
Yeah, I think that What's interesting about this, and when you talk about the idea of her being expendable, I think what makes her so interesting for mm-hmm. this episode is that we've already seen her do this same thing for Sisko, right? In the very first mm-hmm. episode. Yeah. And I think that yeah. that's what makes this really interesting, and that's what makes this work, is that we've already seen her be this type of character. Like a good therapist, you know, she's able to get people to see for themselves what's wrong and then basically be able to help them find the solutions as well. And, you know, mm-hmm. that's one of the beauties of what she does here, I think, for Kira, the same way she did with Sisko. And of course, you know, she has some help from the prophets with Sisko in Emissary. Mm-hmm. But here, the beauty of this is that Kira is giving all of these excuses as to why she's not this. And the moment mm-hmm. that Opaka, you know, through the reading of her paw, it's like that moment of eye-opening spiritual experience of like, oh, no, I am all of the things that I don't want to be. I am all the things mm-hmm. that I need to let go of. And there's just, again, there's something really, really well done about that. And I think, and we've talked about too, I think even when we talked about Kai Opaka in that episode, every time I would just watch this episode, I'm reminded of what a loss it is that she never gets to reappear in the series, because I think she's such mm-hmm. a interesting and moving character, especially in the mm-hmm. ways in which she's able to help people come to know themselves the way that, you know, mm-hmm. our best spiritual leaders are able to do for us, right? And, you know, if anybody's ever experienced that in their life where you've had somebody who's a part of your life through church or whatnot, and they're able to help you kind of find a part of yourself,
mm-hmm.
there's just something incredibly powerful about that. And also, I think by her leaving, it opens up the door for all of the issues you get in Bajor, because she's such a calming
yeah.
presence that right. then they're able to take that and run with it story-wise, of course, throughout the second season and beyond. So, mm-hmm. but like this episode is so quintessential in showing what they end up losing. You know, you can think mm-hmm. of characters in history, right? Where if they were lost, what would happen? You know, I think of like a Winston Churchill or somebody like that. Like if you think of somebody else being mm-hmm. in charge of Britain during that time period that doesn't have the resolve that he does, what happens, mm-hmm. right? I think we get a little bit of that picture in the same, you know, Kai Opaka and her influence over Bajor, her steadfastness and her faith and her mm-hmm. steadiness, that's lost, and Bajor fractures because of it. And so, you know, yeah. I love that you put this first, because her influence is not just profound on Kira, but her influence profoundly lost with Bajor itself.
Yeah, no, it is a great point, the impact to the planet itself. And like you said, when I think about this episode and the fact that this is the end of the road for her, in some ways, definitely, it's a very sad moment, because she is such an important part of Bajor and what's holding Bajor together mm-hmm. after the yes. occupation. As a story, as a television show, everything that we get after wouldn't be possible if she stays around. We wouldn't exactly. open the door for Wynn. So having her leave the show, I think, was important for the development of Deep Space Nine as a series. I think that she served the role in Emissary of establishing the fact that there are these prophets, that the Bajorans are a spiritual people. I know that was already set up before Deep Space Nine, but it was really firmly established here early in the first season. And also welcoming Sisko and positioning his role as the emissary. All of this was quite important. And obviously that wouldn't have worked with someone like mm-hmm. Wynn. So she was needed to set up the series, but I don't think they had a lot of places to go in terms of creating the kind of drama that they wanted to create for this story if she were still mm-hmm. there as Kai. I mean, you could have had her there, and you could have had Wynn and others work to overthrow her, but that creates a lot of internal conflict on Bajor, whereas what you want is you want conflict between Sisko and the crew on the station and the leaders down on the planet. so that you have the Federation involved a bit more.
Yeah.
I did think of a new, I thought of a spinoff, though, a great spinoff for Kaiopaka if she had not been left on this moon.
Ooh.
Paw Patrol.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my. Oh, wow. That was the daddest of jokes. But very funny, actually. So, oh, my gosh. Yeah. I think what's great is that the Deep Space Nine writers, in their decision with what they do with Kaiopaka, they use it as a benefit, not as a detriment, of getting rid of a character mm-hmm. as interesting and as kind of wonderful and powerful as this. They find a way, mm-hmm. in the best way, to make it work. You know, I think they'll kind of do the same thing in season 7, you know, when they have to introduce Ezri. They already have experience about, okay, we did this thing, or this thing has happened, and now we have to deal with it. They do the same thing with Worf, right, in season 4. The Deep Space Nine writers mm-hmm. are so adept at rolling with the punches, whether or not they give themselves the punches or not. They find, mm-hmm. I think, the best way, for the most part, to make these stories move forward and to make them make sense and feel connected. And that's one of the things that we've always really loved about Deep Space Nine. And you had mentioned on our outline the idea of, you know, this story absolutely, I think, talks about the futility of war. I think, to me, I didn't so much take this as the futility of war, but the futility of conflict, to which we don't remember why we're in the conflict. You know, I sure. think that we have seen the idea of blood feuds and vendettas throughout all of history, right, where people can't even really remember what it was that happened that's driving this. And then mm-hmm. when they do, it's so petty. You know, when you actually come down to it, you're like, you mean you've been killing each other over this for how long? For why? You know, I do mm-hmm. really think that this is kind of an episode that really touches on that hate. When hate is all that is fed, what's left is almost, is it worth saving, right? I mean, that's kind of a question you end mm-hmm. up with this. Are these people actually, is there any way to save them? Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting that they do that. And I think it's pretty nuanced in that way as well.
Yeah, these particular people, I think that it would be difficult to save them. Sisko talks about taking them off this moon, relocating them on different planets, and so forth. If they could be relocated on different planets where they don't have to have any contact with one another, maybe they could rebuild, but I don't know. It feels like after so many cycles. One thing that we don't know in the story is how long they've been going through these cycles of fighting and dying and coming back to life and doing it over. It is mentioned in there that it's ancient, which suggests that it's been going on for hundreds of years at least. And if so, after so long, I'm not sure that there's so much that you could really do for them. And they don't seem to think there is for themselves either.
Well, and I do think too that there is an element to that of hopelessness, right? Because they don't have mm-hmm. any hope in the sense that they can change anything. Now, and the problem is they don't realize they could just drop their weapons mm-hmm. and live a whole different life. Like, that's something that mm-hmm. is interesting because nobody even says that in the episode. It's like, mm-hmm. you realize that even if you can't get off this planet, you could live completely different lives that weren't about trying to kill each other every day, mm-hmm. but you're choosing not to. So you're making the choice to live like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing here, which is like, you pity them, but you don't necessarily feel sorry for them because it's somebody who's chosen that way of life, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's the larger ramifications of that are rife in our world today, where you see many people who are legitimately choosing to live a life mm-hmm. that is basically going to kill them, and you pity them, but it's hard to feel sorry for them because they are making that choice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think that, at least in the story, goes back to the idea that this is something ancient that's been going on for so long that they've just given up. If we could rewind to the beginning of it, maybe they have thoughts of how could they break the cycle. But after a while, it just becomes, it's almost just something that they do. It's like innate at this point. Like you wake up and you go kill the other mm-hmm. side.
Yeah.
And that's yeah. that. You mentioned hate and how it fuels conflict. And one of the things about this story too is that, like so many DS9 stories, it feels timeless because the issue that it's addressing is timeless. Humans have always been in conflict with one another, and they likely always will be. But if you look at the world today, I feel like we went through a period of some decades where we were at a relative peace compared with where we were at least earlier in the 20th century. And today it feels like we're sliding quickly back into the conflicts. And the thing about hatred is, how do you build up to hatred? Well, first you stir up anger. And if you look at what's happening in the world today with so many voices, it feels like there are many sides that are just trying to stir up anger all the time, just trying to set everyone against one another because maybe it's profitable for them or they have some other reason. But what it's doing at any rate is it is generating the hatred that is rekindling old hatreds and old conflicts over things that people don't remember what started the animosity mm-hmm. in the first place. And a lot of the people participating in it today certainly don't know because they weren't born when these conflicts, even their parents or their grandparents or their great-grandparents weren't even born when some of the animosity first arose. But it's being stirred back up again today and people are being pitted against one another. And that's unfortunate yeah. that we're not able to break that cycle.
Are you saying that Yoda was right?
Isn't Yoda always right, Matthew?
Well, most of the time.
I mean, so, except for that, like eating bugs and stuff in the swamp. But
yeah, you know, as you were talking, I was just thinking, obviously, of what he says in episode one about fear leading to anger, anger leading mm-hmm. to hate, and hate leading to suffering. And that is what we exactly see played out in this situation, mm-hmm. you know, which is interesting because the idea of punishing people or rehabilitation comes up. Because, you know, the Ennis and the Null Ennis, they're being punished for the fact that they've already been having a never-ending war. And so mm-hmm. basically, it seems almost as though an alien species like the Metrons or something basically put them on this planet mm-hmm. and are keeping them here so that they can live out the very thing that they want, right? It's almost as if somebody on the staff of Deep Space Nine had read C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, which mm-hmm. is all about the idea of hell basically being what people chose, which is mm-hmm. you said you wanted a life without God, and so therefore God gives you exactly what you asked for. Mm-hmm. It's like these people were in this never-ending war and wouldn't stop it, and so they just basically got what they asked for. And I think that the idea of this being like a never-ending hell is a fascinating thing because I think it puts into perspective the futility, right, of this type of behavior. That's where I think the futility comes in, where this idea of what we kind of talked about of hate and, you know, mm-hmm. All of these things and fueling only that. You know, it's like, how do you deal with that? And, you know, it seems almost as like these people are not able to be rehabilitated, but it's also like they haven't learned anything from their punishment either. I think this goes to show in some ways the obstinance of human nature.
Yeah. I did find the punishment itself interesting from a science fiction standpoint. I think there's a whole discussion to be had about whether someone should be punished or should have an opportunity to be rehabilitated. And even if you do punish them, what is the extent of punishment that could be considered reasonable? But from a science fiction standpoint, just in terms of writing science fiction, I found this element of the story to be interesting too, that someone, it's not clear who, at times in the story, I feel like these were two warring factions on the planet, and they were exiled to the moon by others on the planet who wanted to just get rid of them. If you think about it being Earth, and you've got two nations that won't stop fighting each other, and then all the other nations get together and say, okay, we're going to kick you off the planet. But like you said, it could be a race like the Metrons who are observing them and decide to punish them, because it's something the Q Continuum might think of doing, right? They want to teach these people a lesson. So we don't really know. But the idea of manufacturing some kind of nanite that appears to be like a microbe that that resurrects people when they die. I mean, that's a pretty terrible form of punishment. But then to lock it into the environment so that the people can never be removed is another level. But it is an interesting science fiction concept. Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, what makes it interesting, though, is their own rejection of salvation. I mean, Sisko is offering them this opportunity, and in all honesty, they don't really seem to want it. And so, I mean, you know, they have that ceasefire, and it turns into a bloody mess again. And it just seems as though these people aren't really that interested in redemption.
And not in redemption, right, yeah.
And or salvation of any kind. And so I think that goes to show that there has to be in rehabilitation and everything for it to move forward. The person actually has to want it. Mm-hmm. And that's the... What's interesting is that's the juxtaposition with Kira. Mm-hmm. Kira,
right? Yeah,
is the one who realizes that there is something in her that is like these people, and she realizes that unless I want to turn into that fully and completely, I must have a turning. I must do a 180. And therefore, that desire for redemption is what makes it possible for her. And so I think there's something actually really beautiful about that. And I think there's something that really works about the way this episode is structured in that, because Kira would become these people if she didn't willingly turn from that behavior. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a nicely littered story in that way. And that's also another reason why this is not, even though on the surface it might feel like another TNG-style story, because we do have a number of those in Season 1 that feel like they could be at home on that series. But the difference is just what you said. It's so pivotal to a key character on Deep Space Nine that that layering of the story really sets it apart. And in terms of them not wanting, it's interesting that the Ennis are interested in the idea of getting off the moon and being able to be away from the Nol Ennis and have a different type of life, but they're not interested in not killing the Nol Ennis. And I would agree that they don't seem to be interested in their own redemption or salvation. They just want to break this cycle of dying and waking up with a headache over and over, I guess, because they, you know, at the end, when Bashir suggests that he could deactivate the microbes so that the next time they die, they would really die and they can at least end this cycle. They're only interested in that, it seems.
Right, exactly.
In the fact that they would then be able to wipe out the Nol Ennis once and for all. Not because it would benefit them personally in terms of not having to suffer over and over.
Well, I think this shows the way in which these people haven't learned anything from their punishment, you know, and you can, I guess, raise the question, is that because their punishment is such that it does not allow them to learn that lesson, or have they just become so obstinate towards learning any lesson that that's where things are? And I think, again, that's one of the beauties of the writing of this episode, is that I think it leaves it kind of ambiguous as to exactly where that is. And maybe it's a combination of all of it. And that's what makes it so messy and so, like, frustrating, right? Because it really is not something that's easy, or there is no, you know, Band-Aid solution that's going to make this better. Like, there's so much about this entire situation that would have to change that it almost makes it insurmountable, you know? And so, and I think that's one of the ways in which this makes for an incredibly interesting and nuanced episode of Deep Space Nine in the first season. I mean, again, we're talking about first season DS9. So this is pretty incredible, the beginning in a first season of any show, really, to go this deep.
Yeah. And I think it's, I think a lot of viewers probably, they've seen this episode and it's one that they pass over in rewatches, maybe. I mean, there are no Ferengi in it, so maybe people watch it, but I think, but like I'm saying, it does feel like one of those episodes that it's just another episode of Star Trek and they're in caves and you've got people who are fighting with each other, but there's so much more to it. There's so many layers that I think it's definitely worth rewatching with paying a lot of attention to what's being said and how it impacts the characters and all.
Yeah.
Now, Matthew, would you say there's no Band-Aid solution? You don't mean like getting the boy bands that the executives wanted to play in the mess hall and the Enterprise and all together to do a benefit concert to help the Ennis and the Nolanus, right?
Yeah, I don't think that the Backstreet Boys or that NSYNC are going to fix this problem, unfortunately, with a good song and dance number, which is too bad because, you know, who wouldn't have wanted to see that? But no, I don't think that they're going to be our answer.
Well, I will say that when they enter those caves and the flames are going off, for a moment, it did look like someone might be shooting an 80s rock video. All right. So any final thoughts on this one, and what's your rating for Battle Lines?
Yeah, you know, I think that this is a great episode, honestly. You know, for all the discussions we've been able to have, I mean, they only minorly touch on this, the idea of like the Prime Directive and what, you know, Sisko wants to do. I think that might be the only place where this episode doesn't really get a chance to kind of dig in more thematically. It's almost where this episode, you know, if it was on Paramount Plus, you would be able to have it be a full hour and really dig into some of these things. You know, I also think this episode is great for the character of Bashir. I think it shows him to be very competent, not only as a doctor, but just in general, the way he's able to fix the runabout to get it to do what he needs to do. It's great. You know, I think we subtly show that Dr. Bashir is definitely more than meets the eye as a character. Yes, he may be a little full of himself, but he absolutely understands, you know, not only how to be a good doctor, but to fix machinery, which is kind of cool. So the story for Kira, Sisko, everyone involved here, I think is great. And of course, we allow O'Brien to do what O'Brien does best, which is to technobabble his way to a decision. And not just technobabble, but he literally is making something up as he goes along to, to fix the problem, which just shows you how great he is as a character. So all of that is great. And I'm actually going to give this 4.5 out of 5 janky satellites. It's a very, very, very good episode of this series.
Yeah, they might be janky, but they're also dangerous. You better stay away from those satellites.
They are absolutely dangerous. So
the thing about Miles, I will say, I think the presentation of Jadzia here shows that they're still finding her character a bit, because she doesn't quite get where Miles is going with what he's explaining. Right. Whereas I really feel like Jadzia would be all over that and would have figured it out herself.
I mean, his technobabble is really at the level of, like, you know, that Simpsons Treehouse of Horror where the scientist is telling Lisa, well, you know, she wants to be made bigger. And he's like, well, they would take some sort of rebigulator, an idea so utterly preposterous. It makes me want to laugh out loud. I mean, that's kind of what his technobabble sounds like. So I kind of get her like, wait, what did you say?
Matthew, you have memorized a lot of dialogue from The Simpsons. How often do you watch The Simpsons?
What's funny is that I do not watch The Simpsons all that often. And, you know, I mean, I would say probably the first 10 seasons or so are good of that show. And then it definitely is just it's completely hit or miss and or not great anymore. But yeah, those, you know, there's only 9 years of my life where The Simpsons haven't been on. So it's...
well. Yeah, I was going to say, the thing about The Simpsons is that I remember my senior year in high school, we got on a bus to go on a band trip to a competition, and the bus had a TV with a VHS player on it.
Nice.
And one of us had recorded one of the very first episodes of The Simpsons, and we popped it in to watch it on the road trip. That's how long The Simpsons have been around. Yeah. It's really frightening. All right. My final thoughts. One other thing I wanted to mention is that another original concept for this episode is that they would encounter a group of humans and Cardassians who were fighting each other. And they decided not to go down that route because Sisko, Bashir, and Jadzia would be seen as having to take a side. And beyond that, of course, I think that wouldn't have worked. But beyond that, I think it shows creatively how you can start with an idea and you think you have something that's going to help you build this new series and this bigger story that you're wanting to build, but you're focused on the wrong things. You're focused on the species, the humans and the Cardassians.
Right.
And that would have been what TNG would have done. But Deep Space Nine is so much about the characters and what's happening inside us. It's very fortunate that they moved away from that and then they focused on what we talked about so much today, how Opaka was able to help Kira. And it just made what would have been a very average story become a really great story. So I'm going to give this episode 8 differential magnetometers. It's a rating that I'm just crafting right now as we speak. All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Battle Lines. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. If you're already a member, you know how it works. But if you're not, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. And then you'll see a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your comments with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. If you need to find it, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. You can also send us email. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb. And that message will come right over to Matthew and me. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media, including all these new services. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not crashing into stage 18, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over the place under social media with the name MattRushing02. I'm here on the network with a bunch of different shows. You can find me on the 602 Club talking about all of the fandoms outside of Star Trek we love, so I hope you join us there. You can also find me on Literary Treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I also do Warp 5, as we're doing our 20th anniversary rewatch of that show. We've got Saddle Up about Strange New Worlds and The Artificial Tango, which, of course, that was all about Star Trek Picard. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a few shows. One is called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you can find me with Aggressive Negotiations and John Mills as we're talking about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out what that differential magnetometer thingy is, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'll let you know what it is as soon as I finish making it. You can find me elsewhere on the network, as you mentioned, doing all of those shows with you. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me all over the back catalog in many episodes and many shows over the past 13 plus years. You can also find me on social media. I'd love to chat with you there. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active, but you can find me on all the new services, Threads and Blue Sky and Mastodon and all those. And C. Brian Jones is my username everywhere. So I'd love to chat with you there in social media. And if you'd like to help us keep the orb, keep our 30th anniversary rewatch going and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help to find out how to get involved. Please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. We would not be here without you. So thank you so very, very much. Well, Matthew, I think I see some bad stormy clouds rolling in because next time we're going to be talking about the storyteller.
Well, Chris, I'm very excited to see what story that is. And thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.